welcome to dive into the wreckage for the year of our dystopia 2025. It's me and Sean here, and we're talking about everything from Mandani to Russia, Ukraine, to how Colin Drum ended up trending on the internet. It's very weird when that happens to people I've known for like 15 years on the internet and used to be associated with.
I know of him. We're not going to spend like an undue amount of time talking about anybody or any internet drama, but it's funny too. Like, I don't know the guy. You've had him on your show several times, but I know his little tricks, and I saw all these people stumbling into his traps. I was like, oh God, guys, no. But it's not my place to, you know, save people before they hang themselves. It's not my petard. It's their petards they're hanging themselves from. When it's my petard, you know, I'm going to hang myself from it. Other people's petards, that's their business.
Yeah, I mean, we have a problem with the culture of what we might call parasocial politics on Twitter, less on Facebook, because Facebook is just AI slop now. And like, there's is old really? People. Yeah.
Really? No shit. AI is another thing I want to talk about today in light of, let's call it uneven development, or if you want to be reactionary about our geopolitics. I did want to talk about AI, but I'm not on Facebook or Instagram, so I'm not even aware of how enslopified it's gotten. It's
about 60% slop now, and yeah. Your friends feed is like very little of your friends. It's mostly ads and AI slop. Not even the stuff you're following. It's just stuff the algorithm throws at you.
Wow.
X has had staying power, honestly, for political discourse, because it has not. It is full of reactionaries and ads and bots, but AI slop has been less penetrative there because of the nature of text versus video, and. It's not to say that there's not still like there's still the old political groups on Facebook if you know how to find them and dig for them. But in general, all this stuff is dead. But I've known Colin since probably 2013, 2014, somewhere in there. I saw him fall out with Marxism early on, become a modern monetary theorist, fall out with that due to his obsessions with medieval coinage, and then learn to bait Marxist. A lot of the Marxists actually make him look good, because there are some things he does that they don't have good answers for, about like universal subjectitude and the working class. And he's also very good at pointing out that Marxists use Marx as Mad Libs, and then Marxists will say he hasn't read them. Now where he really gets them though is like debating over the psychology of Marx, which can't be known. And I'm just going to say, if you're debating over someone's psychology about why someone wrote something that's not in the text, that's not a viable argument in either direction.
Right.
Unless you have a diary evidence or a letter, you are just making shit up. It's pure speculation.
If somebody is still alive, you could ask them. You can interview them and say, excuse me. Or like you said, if not a diary entry, like maybe somebody that knew them. Like if you wanted to know Marx's psychology, you could probably ask Eleanor Marx. But she's been dead for like a long time too.
Right.
So yeah, I agree. It's a stupid trap to end up in. And what are the stakes of it? I'm not even sure. It's like a sort of demonology sort of thing that I'm deeply uninterested in. And I wish people wouldn't you know, use that as a, I guess, a substitute for making theoretical or political arguments. The one that I was, the trap that I found most disconcerting was people proffering that Comrade Drum hadn't read his Marx. And I know enough about him.
I've seen his appearances
on your show to know that he has, that in fact, that his break with Marx was an honest break. It came from a position of having read Marx and disagree with Marx. And guys, it's not enough to simply say, if you would only have read Marx, you would know. Well, Marx is one theorist among many, and Marxism is one analytical apparatus among many. And good faith people can disagree, even people who have read the entire canon. They could come at the end of it and disagree, because the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And Marxism as like a living political movement and social movement, kind of dead. And so what's left then is just to compare him to other sociologists or other political economists. And on these questions of theory, people can in a good faith way disagree with one another. It's not enough to just say you haven't read the guy. He has, and he disagrees.
I mean, this isn't a week that that people were flaming over Vivek Chhibber in a way where Chhibber and who was using the Brenner debates and the people opposing him who were kind of doing vulgar Wallerstein or just outright like Limbaugh third worldism are racialized capitalism talk. We're just talking straight past each other. And it was, I'm like, Chhibber wanted you to do that. Like, that's why he wrote that article. That's why he did the most vulgar form of Brenner's argument.
This was the argument for those who missed it, including myself, but I did see it mentioned. This was an article that essentially said that colonialism wasn't responsible for capital, for the rise of capitalism. That like capitalism, I guess the argument was that it's not simply stealing from the third world. That capitalism, as you know, Brenner argued many years ago now, 50 years ago now, is instead about changing property relations and incentives in rural England in the 16th century. This is the argument, right?
Except that Chhibber actually doesn't so much pull from Brenner, even though that's what he looks like he's pulling from and says he's pulling from. He's pulling from Mirkin's Wood. And okay.
All right, another good theorist.
He started capitalism earlier than these people. So that one of the debates is when capitalism starts. If you've actually gone into the Brenner debates with the Anner School and then the Brenner debates with the world systems theorists, you'll actually realize that's not an easy question to answer. And even Brenner admits that.
Yeah.
So Vivek Chhibber just like glossed all that over, pretend it's not ambiguous. And my stance on this is that there are elements of colonialism before capitalism. There are elements of settlerism before capitalism. But if you look at the Irish case and right after the English Civil War, during what we could consider like the Cromwell Irish genocides, most of that stuff was perfected concurrent to the establishment of capitalism in politics in a nation. And I don't tend to try to figure out the magic moment where late medieval mercantile economies magically transform overnight into capitalism. I pretty much started with the English Civil War because there are elements of capitalism that go back to the 12th century. If you think it's markets, there's elements of capitalism that go back to like hunter-gatherer tribes.
Right.
So like, I just kept pointing out part of this debate is semantic. Part of this debate is you guys confusing historiography, how we talk about history, with the facts of history itself, because historiography often can't be proven one way or the other. It can only be talked about if it is coherent and aligns with prior understandings of the period.
And there, right? And historiography is always theories as they're relating to other theories. It's like positing a thesis, and it only makes sense to talk about that in terms of what it's trying to refute, which are oftentimes arguments that are using and employing the same evidence, right? But coming to different conclusions. It's social science, right? So there's you're saying that people are trying to debate on the historical evidence when they should be.
No, I'm saying that they are talking about the historiographic frameworks as if they are historical evidence. Because I'm like, part of the problem is you guys don't define capitalism the same way. But you're not even defining capitalism in your debates to get to that point. It's similar with colonialism. Like, I tend to think that there are elements of colonialism pretty much forever, as soon as you had the development of agriculture. But that the colonialism we think of as modern colonialism, either if it's Catholic settler branch or if it's eliminationist Protestant settler branch, does come out of the end of the medieval economy and the more extractionist but less eliminationist one, the like Nouveau Spain one, is less tied to capitalism than the British one, which was extractionist and exterminationist. but it was less extractionist in that it was willing to reinvest in production, although more actually in the core than in the periphery. And you can get this from reading the Irish writings that Marx was aware of this. So like Marx talks about colonialism and imperialism pretty much concurrent to capitalism. And to me also, like, I know what's at stake is really an argument about Mao's like primary and secondary contradictions. That's what's actually being debated.
So is this, I'm trying to, and this is helpful for you that you've sifted through this crap, which a lot of us don't have time for, but like, this is a stand in for arguments between what DSA, like democratic socialists and Maoists.
I mean, it's even Marxist a stand in between Marxist Leninist and Maoist, because Marxist Leninists do maintain that capitalism and colonialism develop concurrently, or that colonialism or imperialism develops after it. Part of the problem is, as I've said before, there's about six different definitions of imperialism in Marxism. Marx doesn't use it the way later Marxists do. He definitely doesn't use it the way Lenin does. I actually think Lenin's reading is consistent with Marx, but not consistent with Marx's use of the term imperialism. So,
but Lenin's whole gambit was that he's historicizing, right? That like right. He's arguing that the imperialism that they're witnessing in the early 20th century is not around yet when Marx is writing, right? So this is not like an update on the theory. Capitalism has reached this new phase,
right? And it's a development of two different theories: a tendency towards monopolization and the involvement of the state with monopolies, and the tendency of profits to decline running straight into each other. Because if you think things have monopoly powers, well, they do, but you still trade on an international market, and that leads to interstate competition as opposed to intercapitalist ones. And that was the theory Lenin was operating under. It's kind of a mixture of Hobson's liberal theory of imperialism, which actually said imperialism wasn't capitalism at all. Capitalism was good, but only in the nation. And Bukharin's critique of that, and a little bit of Hilferding stuff on the development of finance capital. And he adds all that together and picks out two different tendencies in Marx: the tendency of the rate of profits to fall and the tendency towards monopolization and establishment of monopsony power. Which are both in Marx. They seem to contradict each other, because if you have monopoly power, you have pricing power controls, but then you have to deal with states competing with each other for resources, and that's where things come in. Now, what's funny about all that is I actually think this ties into a topic that we want to talk about today, and this is why I call people don't get, like, why I talk about modern monetary theory so much. It's not just as a weird hobby of mine. Modern monetary theorists are right, but also wrong. And I'll get into it, because it's going to explain both the U.S. debt crisis and what we see internationally, and maybe explain what we see with AI. Because if you think about this, there's a tendency of the rate of profits to fall, which leftists in particular want to deny, because profits don't unilaterally fall. But Marx never says they do. Marx actually argues that the development of fixed capital parasites on the development of variable capital. So fixed capital is machinery and automation. And veritable capital is human labor. There are some other forms of fixed capital, like slaves. And that market competition drives fixed capital prices. I mean, drives prices down to the cost of fixed capital, which means that that would lead to a crisis. The way you hedge against that, the tendency you use to hedge against that in Marxism is variable labor rates. And this gets Colin Drum actually pointed this out to me, and it is a thing Marxists don't talk about enough, is in the time period Marx was writing, you had very little deflation or inflation. Currency was very steady for about 100 years. It's actually about the time Marx's death where this radically changes in the late 1890s. And you have the extraction of profits, I think, for us, both through systemic inflation, which is why the crisis of the 70s wasn't like the crisis of the 30s. And you have it in immiseration. Systemic inflation is immiserating, but it's slow and hidden. Whereas dropping wages directly leads to backlash immediately. So this ties us into a few things that modern monetary theory is right about. The state can't run out of currency. The ability to tax makes its currency valuable. The problem that they have, though, is their system only works perfectly in a complete and total autarky. That's been the problem for socialists too. That's why socialism in one country doesn't work, my friends.
Yeah.
It's autarky doesn't work. No geographical area has everything it needs for an advanced productive economy. No geographical area has everything it needs for advanced productive economy. The minerals and everything around has been around the world. That's been true since the late Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Which is why antique imperialism developed in the first place.
And not to mention that nationally, within the nation and also internationally, it's within the nature, the logic of capital to move, you know, and there are various capital cycles, you know, there's fixed capital cycles, a means of production, a factory is only going to be profitable, you know, due to amortization over the course of what, 20, 30, 40 years or whatever. So when the left, when leftists, social Democrats in a previous era, I guess democratic socialists today, when you argue that you want to fix capital in place, fix it to the nation state or fix it to the state of Utah or the state of New York, capital abhors this and we'll find a way around it. And then you've stuck your factories in like Bethlehem, PA, right? In a crisis period, eventually by the 1970s and 80s, where capital flees that area because wages are too, quote unquote, right, too high. And then you end up in a situation where you've got all these nice unions, all these, this strong workers' power. You've got maybe a social democracy in one city or whatever, but no capital, which is to say no resources, which is to say no tax base and no jobs. So this idea of fixing capital in one place, I think, is tied to this question of like methodological nationalism, or this attempt to try to like look at things autarkically, right? Which is impossible in a world system, in a global system. We've seen the fruits of what happens when capital goes away.
Right.
Industrial, so, especially.
To tie this into two different things. One, there are six kinds of Maoism. I know that most Maoists don't know this, but there is Maoism with Chinese characteristics, Xi version, Maoist with Chinese characteristics, Deng version, Maoist international, Marxist internationalist Maoism, which is a kind of third worldism, Maoism, third worldism, or three worlds theory, Lin Bao, Marxist Leninist Maoism, and then Marxist Lenin and Mao Zedong thought. Okay.
Well, now, they've only been at it for like 60 years, and the Trotskyists have been at it long enough to have 37 flavors. So
right. Well, there's also 37 flavors because these Maoist groups break up. These are the broad ideological tendencies. But what makes Maoism unique outside of, I think, Marxist Leninism and Mao Zedong thought, which thinks this is only true for China and certain other developing countries. But what makes Maoism unique is the focus on the primary and secondary contradictions. So
yes,
this is an innovation. This is like the innovation by Mao.
Right.
Mao actually comes out of a problem I am glossing this. There's a very complicated history behind this. But basically, there are two primary thinkers in the Communist Party of China before Mao. And the Communist Party of China was very small. We have to remind ourselves of this. There is a Chen Duxi who takes the fall for the civil war massacres with the Kuomintang, although that's set up actually by the United Front and by the fact that the Kuomintang is what is recognized in the Comintern by Stalin and not the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party is told to be in alliance with them, but the Kuomintang is going to represent them in the Comintern, which is kind of crazy. But
yeah.
I mean, this is why when I say, yes, Maoists always defend Stalin, but they also, if you talk to smart ones, know that Stalin's why the Sino-Soviet split happens. So there's this issue with that. And Mao's answer is, well, you kind of have to do national development. We're going to try to do it autarkically. And we're going to do that by developing our own forces of production, by sheer will, but we're going to try to do it without subordinating ourselves to either the Comintern or the capitalist world. And we're going to try to find our resources where we can find them in the unaligned nations.
And they, if I could jump in too, they leveraged actually Japanese-led development when the Japanese were occupying Manchuria. They were using that as kind of a colony, like an industrial colony out there, mm-hmm. which was taken over. You know, what was left of it after the Civil War was taken over, and then Soviet technicians helped out, right? But, you know, this idea of the peasant commune, this idea of...
the peasant commune, which also had like steel factories in its own backyard, right? Like right. this is... Yeah. This is
what voluntaristic is the other right. point I was going to make. It's this idea yes. of voluntarism, which later on, you know, you'd get with like Che Guevaraism and whatever. But yes, autarky and voluntarism.
Right. Dungism is actually repudiation of this, but it keeps a couple of theories in. And I can get into a lot of this in like a more advanced way. I hate when people pretend like all this is just Western Marxists fighting with each other because of CIA. I'm actually beginning to read Gabriel Rockhill's book. It's some of it's more convincing than I thought, but none of it explains why communism left. It just maybe explains why there were some bad actors in Marxist academia.
Okay. I'm fine with that argument. I wouldn't even disagree on the face of it.
Yeah, my argument with Rockhill people is like, I don't even think you're totally wrong. I just don't think it's all that explanatory for why communism failed. Right. Like it seems like you're picking up on a minor academic tendency and saying this is why the revolution didn't happen. I'm like, I don't know. I feel like the Sino-Soviet split into divisions in China have a lot more to do with that.
Or the failure of the German Revolution. Any number of things.
Yeah.
Probably more important.
Well, yeah, as I've told people, the failure of the German Revolution was a problem. The alternate path would have been Russia and China linking up together. And that didn't happen either because of the Sino-Soviet split. So, but socialism in one country basically doesn't work. There's LaSallianism, which is all over the SPD, but it's also all over the German historical school. Knapp is the founder of Chartalism. He is modified by Michael Innes in Britain. But Knapp was an associate of LaSallians. He was kind of a theorist tied into some of those people. In the middle period German historical school. The German historical school is largely forgotten because while a lot of them flirted with Marxism, they mostly ended up Nazis.
Right.
So, and the other generations were tied into things like Prussian socialism or that they're the socialists that Marx was complaining about in Germany.
Well, and then later on, this takes on a bourgeois cast with like Friedrich List, mm-hmm. right? List in Germany. And then, Sergey, what's his name? Witt, the guy in Russia, Sergey Witt, I think, who was like a listist or whatever. This idea of like tying the national working class, proletariat, and capitalist class together in a national developmental project.
Right. The non-Rod, various forms of what we now call the non-Rodniki project, the non-Rodniki or populist projects. So in China, to break this down, what Mao was responding to theoretically is there's Qin Duxu who kind of gets kicked out. He becomes kind of like a Plekhanovist slash Trotskyist. So he says, like, look, we had the revolution before it developed our internal capital. And then there was I forget the other guy's name, but he died very early. But he was the concurrent to Mussolini. But did not read Mussolini, developed the idea of, well, if peoples are nation bound, then there are proletarian nations. Mao never goes down on proletarian nation theory, but he doesn't ever repudiate it either. And basically, he kind of combines Qin Duxu's kind of classical Marxism, even though he repudiates Qin Duxu. He's kind of written out of the party. And he's made to take the fall for the Kuomintang. Massacres and civil wars.
The Shanghai massacre, right?
Yeah.
Where for people who don't know, the urban Communist Party of China was essentially eliminated, massacred, slaughtered, eliminated.
Right, which is why China's Communist Party had a double peasant base. It had a peasant base early on because there was just more peasants in China by a lot. And then it had a peasant base again after most of the urban communists were killed. So... to bring this back to what Cheever and these Maoists are arguing about, by proxy through this debate between Brenner and the world system theorist, is that Mao posits that colonialism is the primary contradiction and causes capitalism, whereas even Stalin, the Bolsheviks, classical social democracy, see capitalism as concurrent to colonialism and imperialism, and that imperialism is from, you know, is either concurrent or after, and what is universalizing capitalism. The Maoist argument of the primary contradiction means that colonialism has to come first, and if you fight colonialism, which means you need to do national development. Now, ironically, this is what the Soviet Union was doing in the 40s and 50s anyway, was national development with unaligned nations. I mean, Nasser, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's what they were fighting over. And we see this today mirrored through internet debates around these theories that I don't think the people arguing them even, I mean, Chipper probably does, but I don't think the people arguing them really glom on to the fact that these are highly sophisticated theoretical arguments that came up within academia in the 70s that are actually arguing between Maoist and classical Marxist positions that are not using that terminology, so you don't recognize it. And how this relates to us today, as I was mentioning about modern monetary theory, is modern monetary theory works perfectly in an autarky when you don't have to buy anything outside of your monetary command. Warren Moser, one of the founders of the current iteration of modern monetary theory, just says that this is not an issue, that people will trade with each other. And I'm like, it's very much an issue. It's why, like, when people told Egypt to float its currency, which is something that is required under modern monetary theory, although lately modern monetary theory's frustrations and alignments with Marxism, they don't talk about this as much. But currency sovereignty requires you to have the power to float your own currency and trade it on an open market. When that happened to Egypt, it led to a collapse of the of the Egyptian guinea, the Egyptian pound. I lived through that collapse, which I remember arguing with modern monetary theorists, because they were at the time arguing that Greece could just declare emergency, print enough money, and then stimulate production. I'm like, you already have to have the production because Greece doesn't have the materials in its own country at current to run a modern factory system. It will have to get it from somewhere, or at least buy the access to the intellectual property, meaning that they will have to be able to leverage trade already to do that. So modern monetary theory is correct in that, like, we don't need commodity money anymore. We are beyond that point. And this is the thing that Colin Drum, to tie this back in, lobs at Marxists, that Marxists assume commodity money. Marx more or less does, but there are things in the Grungesa where he says that the money could be anything.
Yeah.
But he thinks that no state's powerful enough to enforce that, and interstate competition means that they'll stick to metalism.
And well, if there's one thing that Marx and Marxists maybe didn't anticipate, which was it was this monstrous state apparatus that arises in the late 19th, especially in the 20th century, right? Which serves as like a bulwark for not just capitalist social relations, but accumulation itself, right? And so it's impossible. It would have been impossible for Marx to theorize something that A, hadn't happened yet, and B, was maybe, let's say, historically contingent upon the defeat of the working class, that this entire apparatus, this Bonapartist apparatus should arise in order to, like, create states that could be sufficient to actually control the flows of international money and capital flows and whatnot.
Right.
And working classes.
So there's a couple of different things that Colin is on about, some of which I would actually say a Marxist, he's not totally wrong. One is we assume commodity backed and credit backed money without and discounted state money because we thought no state was powerful enough to enforce it. I think in the 19th century, that's true, with the exception of Britain and its subsidiary empires in Africa. Well, not, and if you actually talk to Chartalists, when they give you examples of early Chartalism, it's like the colonial United States, Rhodesia. I'm like, guys, you should like notice something about all these examples.
But so basically it does pertain within what would become like the Commonwealth countries of Great Britain at like the maximum extent of its empire. So internal to like the imperial economy of the British, which did span like large swaths of the globe.
And when you talk about like Hudson, and this is like what I talk about, like Hudson Bonapartism, Michael Hudson Bonapartism, but like are his Caesarism. Hudson ties it to strong centralized proto-states like, you know, Mesopotamian empires and warlordisms and stuff like that, because they could abrogate debts and whatnot. You also have chartalists who argue, and MMTers who pick up the David Graeber argument, that debt and credit play a huge role in hunter-gatherer and early agricultural societies, which they do. Barter seems to have developed between societies of trust, but not within them. So most economies were gift economies, which are credit debit economies, or honor economies. So we're literally trading honor for access to spoils, our access to surplus goods by showing loyalty to our group or to our leader or whatever. That's like, if you read the Homer, the Homeric economies are this kind of economy. The development of proto-commodity economies, you can read Richard Seifert about this. That's the scholar. He's not a Marxist, but he's actually really good on this. He even talks about how it changes the way people talk about selfhood in early Greek philosophy and in Buddhist philosophy. It's actually really enlightening to read that book. But what you start seeing is these property relations changing the honor economy into a more property holding economy, which is kind of implicit in agriculture, but doesn't fully instantiate in early agriculture, blah, blah, blah. The MMTers go deeper. I mean, I will say this, part of the problem with the Marxists is basically antique economies and anything that's not European becomes here be dragons-ish. Samir Amin talks about this. Jarius Banerjee talks about this, and they're Marxists. So it is something that other Marxists have recognized, that there's not a great understanding of non-European economies.
Right.
Because capitalism didn't happen outside of Europe yet, and it's colonialism that universalized it. So in modern imperialism, which maintains it. I tend to think that the classical Marxist position is correct, but the Maoists have a point that things that happened in late, what we now call late medieval, or you might call like early modern Europe, about the acquisition of territory is what led to the conditions to allow something like capital to be possible in one country. And there were two variant paths that we saw, which is a highly extractive imperialist economy a la New Spain, and then one that reinvested a la England. But that it's not that clean of a history, and our attempts to make it really clean, it leads us to missing things and bad ideas like techno-neo-feudalism and stuff like that, which misunderstands the medieval economy. I bring this up because I sort of think these debates are crypto debates about early 20th century theories. And you do have to have a Marxist historiography to understand different Marxist positions on them. But we do have to admit some things, just like straight up. MMT's right. With state fiat currency, you cannot run out of money. But let's go back to how this affects us today, because this is going to tie into the news. Other currencies don't have to accept your currency. If you don't have commodity-backed money, what you tend to back it up is agreements and Forex. So that is foreign exchange currencies. And the Forex is a basket of other currencies. So it's kind of like a basket of the promises of various productive capacities of different states, backing up the universal currency system by what is accepted in trade. And this was, you know, what dominated the Forex currency accounts and access to Forex was pounds, dollars, and euros, and a little bit of renminbi and yuan, and some yen.
And yen as well.
Yeah, and some Swiss francs, actually. But really, the big three were pounds, euros, and dollars. If that sounds like the Western hegemonic core, it's because it is. Mm-hmm. And yuan being in there was the influence. Now, there have been MMTers who became tied into what they call like geopolitical economy. I don't think these people are actually Marxists. They don't think they're Marxists, but Marxists sometimes think they're Marxists because weird reasons. But they will talk about, I mean, maybe because like Michael Hudson is like Trotsky's godson or whatever. This is true, although he's not a really big Trotskyist. My point on all that is that what you're seeing today is slow de-dollarization. We've actually been seeing it for about 30 years, but the dollar is still had so much dominance from the night from like the results of the Marshall Plan and the Keynesian International and the Bretton Woods Agreement.
And the deals made in the 70 around the petro dollar.
Right. And the petro dollar, et cetera, et cetera, that it's going to take a long time to undo. And a lot of Marxists think that flash pan singular events are going to cause it to collapse. Really, it's going to be more like likely the way that this current stock bubble is going to die out, which is more like the 70s. It's going to be slow bleeding for a long time. And when you look at that and you look at what America did to its own productive capacity, because there is a sense in which America deliberately undercut its productive capacity to have more leverage with its finance capital after the 1970s through neoliberalism, that made producing things super expensive here. But also that was always going to happen because of like Marxist reasons. So to leverage financial trade, we made that more expensive, making us the final key of investment. When people ask why doesn't China do like US dollar MMT, that's why, because it would make their ability to control their own industrial policy nearly impossible. Mm-hmm. The attempt to reshore won't work because it's done by fools who break up supply chains, who don't even think about the repercussions of the fact that we don't have all the things we need in one country, and even where we do, such as there's probably rare minerals under large cities, we are not willing to displace large populations and take the cost to get that, as opposed to buying it on trade, because it would not be rational.
Let me jump in here. One of the contexts of what Derek's talking about here is this essay that I shared by Tim Wu, right? This is from December 13th in the Financial Times. Could America win the AI race but lose the war? The U.S. has gone all in on artificial intelligence, but the idea of an end of times battle with China over tomorrow's key technology is part delusion, part lobbying tool for Silicon Valley. This is the context in which we're talking about this, because as I think we've spoken about on this show before, the stock market bubble, the growth in the U.S. economy, certainly a lot of the jobs being created over the last couple few years has been what appears to be, even members of Silicon Valley and the capitalist press seem to be admitting now, is a massive artificial intelligence bubble, which has a built capacity to it. You know, it's got a actual physical component, which is the growth of these humongous data centers,
which is why they're the only element of the AI bubble that is profitable is actually the physical commodity producing NVIDIA chips for those data centers, which I think actually in this weird way is a vindication of classical Marxism against stuff like neo-feudal theory or something like that, because I'm like, no, that's not actually profitable,
right?
Like it took quantitative easing conditioning, the way quantitative easing hides bad investments by shielding them. It's not entirely injecting money into economy. That's a little bit of a misunderstanding, but it does shield bad investments. And that's how stuff like Facebook and Amazon became dominant in the particular time period that they did. And this is one thing I hate to tell our liberal friends, and even the ones who are even our social democratic friends, is that their policies created the tech overlords, and the tech overlords were always going to be incentivized to jump ship. And they've been producing a weird philosophy to do this going all the way back to the aughts. Like as soon as you read Nick Bostrom, you should have been aware of this. Like they literally thought they were making God. And
there was the transhumanism discourse as well, which starts in the late 1990s. I remember because I read websites like Disinfo and Wired and whatever. Right. Where this idea
was transhumanists versus peak oilers, which today gets replicated in Marxism and degrowth versus bright green. And I have always said these positions are red herrings. They're extremophile positions that keep you from looking at the entire picture.
Thank you. And the thesis of this article, or at least the gloss I'm going to put on the thesis of this article, because there's a lot in here, is very scary if you've bought into the Trump idea, the MAGA idea of reindustrialization, or if you're a social democrat and think that the gains of capital that we've seen in the Magnificent Seven over the last 4 or 5 years or so can be clawed back and used productively in the economy in order to create a bunch of jobs and so like increase social benefits or whatever. Because what this article says, and I think there's a lot of evidence for it, is that AI is understood very differently in China as it is in the United States.
And you see this in the, how they don't build as many fucking like data centers as we do.
And you see in the fact that it's open source. AI is a component that's being, and this should be really scary for people who know their history. AI in China is a component that's being plugged into the vast manufacturing capacity that they have, combined with robotics and combined with management, basically taking factories that employ 2,000 workers a year ago and with robotics and AI now employing 200 workers, which is actually very great if you have a declining population. If you're
right, they're dealing with their population.
It's also great in terms of profits and capital.
Right.
Now, what's happening in the United States, I think all the listeners here who are from the U.S., or at least you must be somewhere within the Anglophone media, understand that there is like an eschatological, sort of almost theological, spiritual imprint to what artificial intelligence is meant to do in the United States. It's this idea of the creation of artificial general intelligence. It's the idea of outsourcing our thinking to the robots, which are going to basically cure cancer, which are going to eliminate poverty, which are going to basically create scientific breakthroughs, the likes of which we've never seen before, create what like a fifth technological revolution we're up to now, or sixth or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's very consumer facing in the United States, and it's very like burnt over district sort of spiritual theological, in the sense that you're essentially creating a god, right? Which is a god machine, which in the meantime we can use as consumers to like cheat on our homework, or we can use to like become our own consultants or get
to lower our cognitive capacity. Yeah. To reduce our ability to even be useful proletariat. I mean, like,
so if people understand out there, and you should check out this article, we'll put the link in the show description. You have two vastly different things, plugging it into a vast and varied manufacturing sector in an economy where prices on goods are actually declining. China's facing deflation already. You have that on the one hand, and then a consumer-facing eschatological AI on the other hand, which is not being plugged into the manufacturing base because the MAGA and also Biden's attempts at reinvigorating American manufacturing have fallen flat on their face. And so instead you have slop videos, you have chatbots, which Barnes kids can use to cheat on their homework or whatever.
And also not get a girlfriend.
You can sit at home and talk to that as your girlfriend instead of having an actual girlfriend. So in the United States, you could argue it's very destructive. It's destructive of society. It's destructive of rationality. And it's ultimately a reflection, I think, of the ways in which American politics and culture has never shed its like 18th, 19th century puritanical sort of Protestant eschatological fervor, right? This has now been imprinted onto these thinking machines, quote unquote, which are really just large language models. And then, of course, you juxtapose that to China, where AI is one of many bets that they're placing, including on green energy, including fucking cold fusion, all sorts of ways in which the Chinese ruling class is attempting to make it the kind of the workshop of the world into the next phase of the Industrial Revolution, with AI being a component of that. So
yeah, they'll be the leaders of the capitalist on this world, Farn, in the future.
Sorry?
The China will be the leaders of the capitalist world in the future, which I'm just gonna piss off all sides of your audience by saying that.
My audience? No, I think
no, I know
that's
no.
The implication that I have from this whole thing is that China will be the successful capitalist power, if not the hegemon. And we could talk about what this means geopolitically.
I don't think China is worried that it's not ready to be the hegemon. I know that.
It's probably not ready. Yeah.
And it is more responsible geopolitically than we are. I mean, like, what are we doing? It looks like we're fucking with Venezuela for domestic political reasons, but they're not even delivering on that. Like they realize it would be more Iraq than Grenada, but they also, so they're not actually doing it, but we'll continue like making life very hard for Venezuela for whatever reason and making it look like we might go to war in a way that's also very unpopular, even amongst conservatives.
Yes.
So,
and over what? And the question, like, so this began, of course, very irresponsibly as an attempt to stop fentanyl, which doesn't even come, as we know, from Venezuela. So this was the wool pulled over our eyes in the beginning of this semi-blockade, now full blockade of Venezuela. But, you know, when Maduro and Trump spoke, according to various sources, Maduro actually offered Trump what you would imagine would be everything that a imperialistic Monroe Doctrine with a Trump corollary U.S. empire would want, which is access to all their oil. You know, we could let their companies back in exchange for dropping the sanctions. They would liberalize like vast swaths of their economy. Maduro offered this to Trump, and Trump said no. And my understanding from the sources that I've heard is that it's not about that per se. What it's about instead is about Chinese and, to a lesser extent, Russian influence, BRICS influence, let's call it, in the Western Hemisphere. And that the question is like not whether the U.S. will get the oil or not, but whether China will get a piece of the Venezuelan economy, which is to say the Western Hemisphere. And that, as thus far, seems like something that Maduro is and company are not prepared to.
I feel like this is the greatest hits of our stuff coming home the roost at once. That's why I'm calling this episode One Crisis After Another. But but like seriously, because let's look at what I've talked about with multipolarity. I've said multipolarity implies multiple empires that exist in tension with each other. What no one talks about this with the advocates of multipolarity is that it makes the borderlands areas of war. For us, that would be Latin America. For Russia and Europe, that's going to be the Baltic and Balkan states. For China, that's East Asia and maybe West Asia, right up to Russia, depending on when that tension really hits off.
Yeah.
Right now, the United States is uniting those areas, but we know that when the United States is not agitating them, Japan, Russia, China, and India are always switching sides who they are aligned with, except Russia and China have been stable now that China, now that Russia's not communist, which is something I want people to pay attention to.
Curing the Sino-Soviet split through capitalism.
Right. But you point all this out, and then let's add a few other things that this means. One, the Western countries are drowning in debt. The United States now, so I was saying to, you know, for those of you who don't know, I'm in the DSA now, but I actually went to DSA. I was like, let's tax the rich. And I was like, so they can pay it back to themselves. And like, what do you mean? And I'm like, the largest thing that we pay out now so that people continue keeping our Forex, which is what the bond market is for, to tie this all back in. We are losing that by the day. And if we lose that, we lose our ability to purchase outside of the country. And it will also make reshoring nearly impossible. The reason why we were able to reshore the way we did is two things. We stole all the shit from the British in the first place, literally stole it. And then when we used it to rebuild Europe so that we could access our excess, so we could access and then export our excess production, even at a lower cost. And the moment Japan and Germany became competition for that, it started not to work. So I bring all this up because leftists are always looking at like 10-year chunks or this or that, or like, oh, the, you know, like I said, the central truth for modern monetary theory, the government can't run out of money. No, but people can quit using, people can quit accepting its currency if you don't pay your debts on the bond market. And that's why if you were to tax the rich today, who is it going to go to? Well, the rich own like 70% of the bonds. They're just going to pay themselves back with it, which is also why large corporations don't really care. They make money off of paying taxes. Which I know that this is going to blow people's damn minds, but they make money off of paying taxes because they get it back in bond receipts. and we now pay more on servicing the debt, aka paying the bonds, than we even do the military. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of it goes to military development, which is all boondoggle for like Northrop Grumman. And then at the very end, you have like our stupidly rebate funded tax write off healthcare system, which is also exploding in cost.
$38 trillion, folks. Right. Hold on to that number in your heads for a second. $38 trillion. You know, since we've been kids, and I remember coming into the city in the 80s and 90s, and you'd see that billboard that a billionaire put up with the national debt. Like, you know, it was going up all the time, and people, right wingers especially, gold bugs and libertarians, have been screaming about the national debt and the threat of hyperinflation for as long as I've been alive, right? But when you go from $8 to $38 trillion, when the U.S. military budget is somewhere around $800 billion, but debt service is actually more than that, you have a real crisis. And this, of course, is not just a United States problem. It's a France problem. It's a U.K. problem. It's certainly an Italy and Spain problem. And it is now a Germany problem, as Germany seeks to remilitarize, which is to say reindustrialize, using basically, you know, debt instruments that constitutionally they haven't been able to use until their constitution was changed just recently under Schultz and Merz in order to allow that, right? So this is not just, oh, America's a profligate spender, or like the dollar-denominated global economy is leading to a certain like a debt capacity of the United States that's being reached. It's like, no, this is a problem across the West. And what I would like to point out, to bring us back to the larger conversation, is a deep irrationality that exists right now in the world, which is, again, the fact that you have inflation throughout the world, a kind of durable inflation.
Except in China.
But in China, right, which is the workshop of the world, you have deflation. So you have an inflationary half of the economy living next to a deflationary half of the economy. And rivalry between various different capitalist states and these two different blocks that are arising right now, at least two, probably more, means that these two things can't be united. You can imagine a world, a rational world, in which China's capitalist model and the United States capitalist model could live in harmony. You could have free trade among them, and you could actually maybe even that inflation out. But no, it's not to be. And I think this is points to like the deep incoherence, or at least like the great struggle that's happening right now within the capitalist world over not who will be dominant in the future. That will be the result of economics and politics, right? But instead, over two different world systems, if I don't want to call it that, because then people will get mad because it sounds like a Wallerstein type thing. But this inflationary and deflationary economies, these things living side by side without there being a way to unite them, or at least them being disunited in very particular ways, I think is the very interesting aspect of the global economy that we need to be looking at moving forward.
So all this means, guys, that to tie it back into, you know, my arguments in the DSA, because I am in a weird place. I am a social Republican, small r, a socialist or a communist, with Republican leanings, aligning me with Mug. But I think the economic critiques of Phil Neal and Jamie Merchant and a lot of the later end of communization is correct about the limits of the classical workers movement. And because of the structure of the economy, because basically I participate in union stuff. I'm in a union. I'm in a workers center org. I am on the labor committee in the DSA. That's why I entered it. That and to vote against stuff like Mondani. Which is turning out
Wrecker.
Yeah, worse than we thought, which also really hurts we can use cadres to get past the problems of endorsing people like AOC. And I have come in and looked at all this and said, like, okay, so we have massive problems here. One, the organic composition of capital due to automation and fixed capital is such that building factories, even in the developed world, don't yield the jobs that they used to yield. That is both internal to the U.S. economy and in places like Africa, which leads to a semi-lumpenized proletariat around the worldwide and a skilled proletariat that is being truly proletarianized. So for all the complaints about the PMC, well, they're becoming proletarians, motherfucker. Oh, but they're a different class. I'm like, well, but where's this industrial formal proletariat that you talk about? It's like a smaller and smaller portion of, since we tried reshoring, you know what's happened? That sector has shrunk faster.
Yes. We have lost industrial jobs over the last 11 months, for sure.
Right. So this is absurd to me. And this is what the Vivek Chibbers of the world want, is like us to refocus on the industrial capitalists. Of course, they have no ties to that. They're all fucking professors. But also, there's no dealing with the fact that where the manufacturing is strongest is not in union states, where unions are strongest in union states amongst professional organizations. And it's not just government workers. Frankly, it's people who are quasi-petite bourgeois like you.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's like none of these, like even the blue collar workers that people fetish don't resemble the pre-1960s industrial working class. They just don't. And there's, and this is also true in the developing world, which is no longer developing in a lot of ways anyway.
Mm.
Because the automation gains are what they are. Offshoring was a way to stall for automation to come in and to leverage uneven development. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, if you let that stuff stay there forever, it might start to even out development. So you have to keep moving, and eventually you run out of places to move to. And yeah. So then you start reinvesting in industrial technology. And basically around 2020, after COVID, we saw the limits of that. And that's why we saw these technologies that had existed. And there have been papers predicting that some emergent trends would allow this. But we've unleashed a technology that we don't, when I say this, I mean this literally. I've heard this from multiple sources. We don't actually truly understand the way AI emergence works.
Mm.
Like its cognition is not comprehensible to us. We cannot retro engineer it. We can only train it.
Mm. Shit, our own fucking consciousness isn't recognizable to ourselves either. We're in, right, like, we're kind of in cloud cuckoo land when it comes to this stuff. We're being led by the nose, as it were. Varn, I would like to, since we're at about the hour mark, mm-hmm, I would like, because you and I are both now lashed to some sort of organizational discipline, I'd like to go behind the paywall where we can talk more about your struggles, your victories and losses within the DSA, which you are of now a member. And I could talk about the ILC and our theory of change. And what we've been up to recently. And I think we can continue this very fruitful conversation about AI and geopolitics, because I have a lot to say on this stuff. I have been following a lot of podcasts now. I listen to your podcast. I don't really listen to too many other podcasts, but similar to like how Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn were so kind of powerful politically because they came of age like before the neoliberal era, and their critiques and their policy positions 10 years ago actually were like a throwback to a previous period, which most other people had forgot about. A very similar thing is happening in the military world and the diplomatic world, where you have a lot of podcasts, especially on YouTube or whatever, like in international realists, or like, what do they call it? Like geopolitical realist type podcast, where there's a lot of people coming out the woodwork now who made their bones in diplomacy and the military back before the neoliberal turn, back before the end of history in the Cold War. And they're kind of like Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn were able to kind of understand this era in a way that maybe people who were born in the end of history or raised in the end of history, were Clintonites or Blairites or whatever, maybe don't understand. So I'd like to talk about all of that behind the paywall. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
All right, folks, if you're not patrons of Varn Vlog or this wreckage, I don't know what you're even doing with your life. You're only getting, I'd say half the content, but like we might go on for much longer than that, maybe a third or a fourth of the content that you might otherwise be getting. So do sign up. And one of the advantages of going to patreon.com/barnvlog is that you get to see our beautiful faces. You get to see Varn's shirt, which is a Gnostic cross. And you get to see me in front of a blank wall here. You get to see our gesticulations. You get to see when we accidentally drop cans or something like that. So do sign up for Varn Vlog. Do sign up for this wreckage, and we'll see you on the other side of that paywall.
Like